For many years, we have felt a very definite part of the United States, and we have called this the mainland. Although about 80% of our population is non-white, they're very American in their way of living and in their political loyalty. I feel very much at home here in Florida, for I see very little difference. The only thing is that we have mountains in Hawaii and you don't here in Miami, and you grow oranges instead of pineapples. We speed along six-lane highways. We despair over the terrible city traffic, for one out of three people in Hawaii owns a car. We watch the same TV programs that you do. We complain about high prices and high taxes, just as you do. And we shop in huge supermarkets. Recently, I took some Texas friends through our ultra-modern, very new, and gigantic Ala Moana shopping center. And believe it or not, these Texans admitted that they had not seen anything like it in Texas. We have American schools of high standards, and these schools are so effective in the teaching of Americanism to people of various racial backgrounds that it's not unusual to hear a high school student orate about the ideals for which our pilgrim forefathers fought and died. I was brought up according to Japanese customs and language, for my parents came from Japan in the early 1900s and knew no English, and knew only the Japanese way of living. But I have never thought of myself as anything but American, and I have never felt anything but pride in the American ideals. It is difficult for you to understand, perhaps, how a person can be proud of his other than American racial heritage and yet be a loyal American citizen. It was a shock to us Japanese Americans of Hawaii when we realized at the beginning of World War II that our loyalty was questioned, and the Japanese American boys were quick to offer themselves for combat duty. I think that one of the greatest contributions that Hawaii can make to the world and to the United, to its country, is to bridge the gap between the East and West and to demonstrate that red, brown, yellow, black, and white can live together in peace and understanding. President Eisenhower told the Indian Parliament in Delhi when he visited there in December, and I quote, "The men and women of the new state have their ancestral homes in Asia and Africa and Europe and the two Americas and the islands of the earth. These people are of every creed and color, and yet they live together in neighborly friendliness and mutual trust, and each can achieve his own good by helping achieve the good of all. Hawaii cries insistently to a divided world that all our differences of race and origin are less than the grand and indestructible unity of our common brotherhood. The world should take time to listen with an attentive ear to Hawaii." Hawaii's population is made up of 38% Japanese, 20% Caucasian, 18% Hawaiian and part Hawaiian, 12% Filipino, and smaller percentages of Chinese, Koreans, Puerto Ricans, and others. There is much interracial marriage among these various races, and it's predicted that in a few generations, there will be no distinct racial group in Hawaii. Our Baptist work has, from the very beginning, been interracial, and we have leaders and members in all of our churches of the various races. At Olivet Baptist Church, for instance, the pastor, Dan Kong, is Chinese. The minister of education is Japanese. The chairman of the deacons is Caucasian. One of the deacons is Hawaiian. On our State Women's Missionary Union Executive Board, we have Mrs. Charles Meyer, Caucasian, as president. Mrs. Bruce Arakaki, of Okinawan descent, as secretary. Mrs. Alfred Chong, Chinese, as treasurer. Ms. Bertha Kim, GA director, a Korean. Mrs. Arianwen Prokopchak, a Welsh lady who was a missionary to Russia a number of years ago. Mrs. Mori Hiratani, our State Women's Missionary, our State Community Missions Chairman, a Japanese. She's the wife of the president of a Hawaii Baptist Convention, and I believe she is somewhere in the audience this afternoon. I haven't spotted her yet. We have several consecrated Negro women who serve in leadership places in some of our local societies. Perhaps one of the questions that almost everyone has asked me, or the question that has been asked me most frequently, is this: what has statehood meant to Hawaii? It's meant a lot of things. Economically, statehood has brought a burst of new activity throughout Hawaii. New business enterprises are coming in from the mainland. New industries are being developed. New buildings are springing up. Tourists are pouring in by the thousands, and the skyline of Waikiki changes monthly as new buildings go up. And our kama'ainas, those are the old-time residents of Hawaii, shake their heads and say, before long, Waikiki is going to be just like Miami Beach. Politically, statehood has brought us the right to full voting representation in both the House and both houses of Congress. It has brought us the right to vote for the president, and oh, how we're looking forward to the first election when we vote for the President of the United States. The right to a voice in amending the Constitution, the right to representation in the choice of federal judges, the right to vote for state officials and to select our local judiciary. It's brought a lot to us politically, hasn't it? Statehood also brings about a great change in the Southern Baptist mission work. 20 years of Foreign Mission Board activity will come to an end on December 31st, 1960, and the work will be transferred to the Hawaii Baptist Convention. On December 12, 1940, the Hawaiian mission of the Foreign Mission Board was organized by 11 missionaries who were relocated from China and Japan. They discovered that these paradise islands were not really a paradise, for only 6% of the population was Christian. They found many temples and many churches, but very few born-again Christians. Years ago, Hawaii's religion was one of human sacrifices, taboos, and superstitions. The taboo system was abolished in 1819 through the courageous act of the Queen Mother, Keopuolani, wife, or widow rather, of Kamehameha the Great, and the whole religious system of Hawaii crumpled. Into this vacuum came the first Christian missionaries in 1820. These early congregational missionaries did much for the Hawaiians, not only spiritually, but also educationally, economically, and socially. Today, this denomination is the second largest evangelical denomination with 117 churches and 16,000 membership. In 1862, the Church of England sent a clergyman on the request of the Hawaiian King and Queen to serve as chaplain to the royal family. This was the beginning of the Episcopal Church in Hawaii. Today, their membership numbers 17,500, and it is the largest evangelical denomination in Hawaii. Catholic priests attempted to establish a mission in 1827, but the royal family, already influenced by the congregational missionaries, did not approve of having images of Mary and Jesus and asked the Catholics to leave. However, French warships came in 1839 and forced King Kamehameha III to allow the priests to land and to begin work in the islands. Today they claim a membership of 200,000. Mormons arrived in 1850 and immediately won many to their faith, and they number about 20,000. When Chinese laborers came in 1852 and Japanese laborers in 1886 and the years following to work on the pineapple and sugarcane plantations, they brought their religions of Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism, and Shintoism. And these religions have a strong hold on the Oriental population even to this day. The Methodist, Lutheran, Seventh-day Adventist, Disciples, Salvation Army workers came in the 1880s and the 1890s. The Baptists were one of the last. A group of Baptists organized the first Baptist church in Honolulu in 1930. This church later became affiliated with the American Baptist Convention, and today they have two other branch churches. One of the leaders of this First Baptist Church was Charles J. McDonald, a Honolulu businessman who established a mission in the town of Wahiawa, 20 miles out of Honolulu. And it was there in this mission that I first heard the gospel as a little junior girl. I was converted there through the efforts of this Christian layman. This mission became the first Baptist church to become affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. At about the same time, another layman, Joseph Tosowski, a lawyer in Honolulu, established a mission in Honolulu, and this mission became the Olivet Baptist Church in 1941, the first Southern Baptist church in Honolulu. The 30 or so charter members of this church called missionary Victor Kuhn to serve as its pastor, and then missionary Edwin B. Dozier to lead the Japanese-speaking congregation. Today it is the largest church, Baptist church in Hawaii, and is the mother and grandmother church of several others in the city. Because the response of the people of Hawaii to the Baptist message was tremendous, Southern Baptists gave great support during the last 20 years in prayer, personnel, and funds through the Foreign Mission Board, through the Women's Missionary Union, through you. Every piece of precious land that we own in Hawaii has been purchased with the help of the Light and Moon Christmas offering. And every building, except the Olivet Educational Building, has had the help of your missionary offerings. The Wahiawa Church first met in an open pavilion in the public playground, and later in rented store buildings. Olivet began in an old residence, and later bought three large corrugated tin buildings. The Nuuanu Church met in a large tent. Wailai, Kailua, Aina Haina, and Pearl Harbor churches began in public school buildings. Kaunakakai Church started in a deserted Buddhist temple. And Kahului Church Mission met in a Buddhist social hall. Several churches bought army huts and renovated them for their use. These churches have attractive buildings today because of your generous missionary offerings. Southern Baptists grew rapidly because of your strong support. Today we have 24 churches with a membership of 5,123 and a Sunday school membership of 8,500. We are the third largest evangelical denomination in Hawaii, incidentally. However, we have grown like hothouse plants, and now the hothouse is being removed, says Dr. Winston Crawley. We have been in the childhood stage when our needs have been cared for by you, our loving parents. And now we are in the adolescent stage. But like most adolescents, we're full of enthusiasm, vigor, and optimism, working out our problems and aiming toward mature adulthood. The Women's Missionary Union has had a great part in this growth. For in almost every church, we find strong women leaders and not too many men leaders. Thanks to your help through the Mrs. W.J. Cox Fund, we have been able to advance our Women's Missionary Union work much faster than some other phases of convention work. The women were able to establish a central office and elect a full-time executive secretary in 1954, whereas the convention in general is just now beginning to have full-time workers. The executive secretary treasurer, Mr. Stanton Nash, was elected last year. And the director of religious education, Mr. Sam Choi, was elected the early part of this year. Every church has a graded women's missionary union. Almost as soon as a mission is established, a girls' auxiliary and a sunbeam band is started, in many cases before the Women's Missionary Society. We pay tribute to our women missionaries who have led us in this work. We already miss those who've gone on and left our field. We miss Mary Lee Ernest and Martha Morrison and Olive Allen, who have gone on to Malaya and Thailand. We shall miss Mrs. Sam Longbottom, who will go to Vietnam later on this year. And Miss Hannah Plowden and Miss Alda Grayson, Mrs. H.P. McCormick and Mrs. J.H. Ware will retire soon. Several more will retire in the next few years, and others will transfer to other fields. And we hardly know how we can get along without their help. But they have trained our local women well, and we hope that the local women will take their places of leadership. May I tell you about one of these local converts? whose name is Mrs. Kimie Gusukuma, a local Women's Missionary Union president and our state stewardship chairman. Raised in a strong Buddhist home, Kimie never was satisfied with the Buddhist worship in her home and at the temple, and for years, even after she married, she searched and searched for salvation, and she finally found it in the Wailea Baptist Church. At a Women's Missionary Union house party several years ago, her Christian life was quickened, and she began her adventure of witnessing and prayer, and I wish you could hear from her own lips her testimony, which will move you to tears. Her husband, her five older brothers and sisters, her parents, her husband's parents, and most of her friends were devout Buddhists. But in spite of persecution, criticism, anger, and scorn on the part of these Buddhist relatives, she lovingly kept on witnessing to them. When her husband's elderly parents became Christians, she began to realize the power of prayer. Then her husband was won. But with her sister and brothers, she met a stone wall, a severe test where it came when her Buddhist brother, a devout Zen Buddhist, became critically ill. She doubled her efforts in prayer and witnessing, but was severely criticized by the rest of the family, who told her, "Quit trying to make him a Christian. Leave him alone because he has his own religion." She replied, "I cannot leave him alone, for I want him to know the love of Christ and the gift of eternal life." Her brother's last words to her was, "You must not study only Christianity, you must study Buddhism as well." And he died without the Lord. Another severe test came when her six-year-old son became critically ill, but God spared his life miraculously. She said, "I know God saved my husband 3 months ago so that we could go through this hard experience together as Christians. I could not have borne it alone." Mrs. Gusukuma is one of hundreds who have been won by your missionaries and our other workers from Buddhism, from atheism, from indifference. And upon people like these fall the responsibility of carrying on the Baptist work in this new era. The Hawaii Baptist Convention has already taken important steps to meet the needs of this transitional period. Serving his second term as president of the Hawaii Baptist Convention is Moriyoshi Hiratani, who was converted under the ministry of James Belote, who was pastor of the Wahiwa Baptist Church during World War II, now a missionary in Hong Kong. He and, that is Mr. Hiratani, Missionary Victor Kuhn, Field Secretary of the Foreign Mission Board, and others worked together, and the Hawaii Baptist Convention approved the 10-year program, a plan whereby the board would grant to our field a lump sum of money for a period of from 10 to 15 years on a diminishing basis. During this period, the churches receiving salary aid from this fund would assume 10% of their salary load, increasing this by an additional 10% year by year, until in 10 years, the churches will be self-supporting. We do not know how this will work, but we are full of hopes that it will, and we are certainly grateful for this continued help from the Foreign Mission Board. To help with building costs, the board is allowing the convention to administer the building and loan fund, upon which all the churches have depended to finance their new buildings. The board's gift of the Hawaiian Baptist Academy and the Baptist Student Center brings further responsibilities to the convention. Another important step was taken, as I've already mentioned, in the employment of an executive secretary treasurer. When Mr. Stanton Nash, who was assistant to Dr. Herschel Hobbs of First Baptist Church, Oklahoma City, came to take part in our annual Bible conference last June, the people were impressed with his ability and leadership qualities, and a few months later elected him to this difficult and important position. His optimistic and aggressive spirit is challenging the churches to increase their cooperative program gifts in spite of the added local expenses and to continue conquering new areas through new missions. In keeping with the 30,000 movement, a goal of 40 churches by 1964 has been suggested by him and by Dr. H.B. Ramser, chairman of the Missions and Evangelism Committee. This will double the number of churches during the Jubilee period. 3 new churches have been constituted and 3 new missions have been started this year in 1960. Of the 24 churches, only 3 are self-supporting so far. And 17 of these churches have less than 200 members, and only 1 has more than 1,000. The leadership and membership are young, and many of them are first-generation Christians coming from Buddhist backgrounds. The adult membership is small in most of the churches, and only few have large incomes. But the churches have many strong spiritual members, and we're looking forward to several becoming self-supporting in the next few years. They will not wait for the 10-year period. If we are to continue the same rate of growth in the next 20 years, we greatly need your prayers. As your gifts diminish, let your prayers for us increase. Said one of the old-time members who struggled with a faithful few years before Southern Baptist opened mission work, "We struggled with our small mission work for years. Then suddenly, thousands and millions of Southern Baptists began praying for us in 1941 and the years following, and the work began to go forward. Surely we know the power of your prayers." Our prayer requests are many, but I'll just close with 3. First, pray for our leadership, our pastors, our convention leaders, our WMU leaders, the leaders in the young local churches, for many are young in years and experience. Pray for new pastors and workers to fill the places of the missionaries who will be leaving us. The president of our convention, the director of religious education, many of our pastors are men of only about 30 years of age. Over half of our Women's Missionary Union presidents are young mothers in their 20s and 30s. Second, pray for our young people, our young membership, that they may become stabilized. For many take on great responsibilities beyond their years and experience. Many in their teens must make a choice between loyalty to their Buddhist parents and loyalty to Christ. And all the Buddhists are working in strong force. Just a month or so ago, Buddhist leaders of Hawaii and California, or the West Coast, met together in Hawaii to make plans whereby they might reach the young people. They said, "Our services are in Japanese and they're not reaching the young people. Let's have services in English. Let's have graded Sunday school literature. Let's work on a united method of propagating Buddhism among the Niseis. Let's have clinics for Sunday school teachers and an emphasis to reach laymen." Doesn't that sound like our Southern Baptist program? And yet it's all in the name of Buddha. They even discussed whether to change the name from Buddhist temples to churches. Our young people need your prayers. 50% of the population of Hawaii is under 25 years of age. In our Women's Missionary Union, 72% of our membership is young people, made up of young people, as compared with about 45% on a southwide level. Third, pray that we may make a concerted effort to win adults, the parents of our young people who are so faithful. It's a very long, slow process. And when even one parent is won, there's great rejoicing by the whole church, for it is a heartbreaking experience many times. My own parents were a great prayer burden to me for many years. Every effort I made to speak to them ended with no result, and often were met by rebukes and excuses and rebuffs. For they were determined to stay true to the religions of their ancestors, Buddhism and Shintoism. During my years of school here in the on the mainland, many friends promised to pray for my parents, and through these 20 or more years, I received letters from them asking, "Are your parents saved yet? We're still praying for them." And how grateful I am for those prayers. Many times I felt that it was an impossible and hopeless task. And I felt that some tragedy would have to come upon our family in order to make mother and father realize their need of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that came in the spring of 1957, when father suffered a severe heart attack and pneumonia and other complications brought about by prolonged drinking, which had become an increasing problem in our home. And there, as he fought with death, we prayed. Friends throughout Honolulu and the islands prayed. And God miraculously spared his life that he might have another opportunity to accept Christ. Mr. Hirano, our Japanese pastor, came and prayed with him and witnessed to him and talked with him. And one day, when he was better, he asked, "Will you accept Christ as your Savior now?" And Father said, "Yes, I believe." He lived for 14 months after that, touching neither alcohol nor tobacco. He quietly went to glory the summer of 1958. When Father made his decision, Mother followed, and she too is a Christian today. Father was 76 years old when he died. And as we stood around his deathbed, knowing that he was gone, the first words that Mother said was, "We will have the funeral in the Wahiwa Baptist Church." You cannot fully realize what it meant to Mother to make this decision for someone with a strong Buddhist background. A Buddhist funeral is about the most important thing in life. And to this funeral in the Baptist church, hundreds of older Buddhist friends came. Many of them had never been inside a Christian church before. Many had never been to a Christian funeral before. And as Mr. Hirano told the story of Father's conversion, they listened, they heard the gospel, and Mr. Kong, who was then pastor of that church, preached in English and presented the gospel again. And so it is not impossible. These hundreds and thousands of Buddhists and others can be won to Christ. Forces of evil are becoming stronger and stronger as material prosperity increases in our islands. And never had we realized before how relentlessly these forces are coming on as when we saw the eruption of our volcano. And as people stood and watched that violent action, they said, "Surely hell must be something like this." And we saw the little village of Kapoho just completely covered over and burnt up and destroyed. Nothing that human beings could do could stem the tide. But we do know that the tide can be stemmed to stop these forces of evil and sin. The power of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so through our combined prayers, your prayers and our prayers, we can overcome all obstacles, and the future for the work in Hawaii is bright. And how glad we are that we can release our missionaries. We are sad that we're going to lose them, and it challenges us. But we are glad that they can be released to fill such great needs in the Orient and other places. But the vacancies they leave must be filled only through your prayers. The God of Jeremiah of old said, "Call unto me, and I will answer thee, and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not." And the same God is at work today in Hawaii and around the world to show us great and mighty things which we know not.
I'm not certain what protocol is to conduct in one of these things. Will you allow me to sort of put it back this way? Let's turn, please, to hymn number 20, "Rescue the Perishing, Care for the Dying." Hymn number 20. May we stand, please, as we sing. May we stand.